Welcome to The Reserve, a news and thoughts podcast from the Centralverse. I'm your host, Caleb Nygaard, and today is episode number 43. Sir Paul Tucker is currently a research fellow at the Masavar Rahmani Center for Business and Government at Harvard Kennedy School, and he's the former deputy governor of the Bank of England. He was there from in that position from 09 to 13, so really important in times for central banking. His new book is out now, Global Discord, Values and Power in a Fractured World Order. Paul, thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I'm delighted to welcome Carrie Mott as well, Research Associate at the Yale Program on Financial Stability. Long overdue. Carrie, welcome to The Reserve.
Happy to be here. Loyal listener since episode one, but first time co-host. So thanks for having me.
It is about time we brought you on. I have to say real quick, Paul is going on book tour right now. One of the places he's coming in the next few weeks is in Chicago. Is it at the Council of on Global Affairs?
It's not. It's the Booth School. I'm going to be
Chicago.
I'm going to be speaking in the Stigler Center. And then doing a seminar there with Luigi Zingales and the Nobel Prize winner, Roger Myerson.
Amazing. Amazing. Okay, I'll make sure to include links to a couple of the upcoming events. So if you're in those cities, you can check them out. I have to say here at the top that was my introduction to you. You will certainly not remember this, although there is a YouTube recording of it that I found this week as I was going back on your first book tour. I skipped out. I took an extra long lunch I was at the Chicago Fed at the time, and I walked across Millennium Park to the Council on Global Affairs tour for a lunch event that you did there. And afterwards, I was considering at the time going to work at the Yale Program on Financial Stability, and I asked you if you'd heard of it, not knowing that you were on the advisory board, and you had glowing remarks. It was one of the tipping points for me deciding to go. So it's kind of fun.
And you went there. It's a very good initiative. And I'm an Englishman, so I wouldn't say that unless I meant it.
I love it. Well, we're happy to have you here. We're excited to dive into this. This book is a solid piece of work that crosses a lot of disciplines. And I wanted to just start there by asking if you could just give us a little bit of the origin story of the book itself. And I want to frame it mostly, it has a lot of parallels to your first book. And I wonder if you were including the international aspect in the beginning and then decided there's just too much material and this needs to be two projects, or was it more of a sequential from the beginning? I would do one and then the other.
No, there's an element of that. Unelected Power, my first book, touches on, so what when these unelected central bankers and unelected regulators gather together in Basel or the IMF or WTO or whatever. But I didn't really develop that very far in Unelected Power. So there was that loose end. But a kind of more profound thing, really, and this goes back to while I was in office, before the crisis, in fact, is... I was involved in international institutions. I chaired some international committees, and I started wondering about, well, how will this change if the whole global order changes? If we don't just live under the umbrella of the American order, but actually it's more contested than that. And whereas my first book kind of took for granted a functioning constitutional democracy, and is it okay to delegate to an antitrust agency or a central bank agency? When you go into the international arena, you can't just take peace and stability and order and all those good things for granted. You have to think, how do they come about? And what does that mean for international organizations and institutions? And so the book starts at a higher level in a way, even while it drills down to concrete things like the fund and the WTO and Basel.
Amazing. And were you working with editors, or did you work with the same editors on both books? Or you?
No, it was a different editor this time. And actually, one editor, and they switched between editors. One had mat leave, the other one had paternity.
Yeah.
And that was quite nice, getting input from two people. And it was a productive process. But it was also during lockdown. So it was, which kind of amplified a peculiar thing about writing a book, right? The writing bit, I think the researching and writing is quite an introspective, almost introverted, isolated activity. And it for sure was because of lockdown.
Yeah.
Then when you reach this stage, when it's come out, you have to flip from one, the introverted side of one's character, to the extrovert side of one's character and become a kind of solipsistic marketing, you know, buy this book, it's really interesting. And that's the kind of the two modes, the two parts of book writing and marketing couldn't be more different, really.
Yeah.
Well, indeed, it is very interesting. So a quick anecdote to share, which also functions as a disclosure on my end. So I'm reviewing Global Discord for the Cambridge Review of International Affairs. I really liked Unelected Power in 2019. So I said, sure, I'd be happy to do a review of Global Discord, really like Paul's work. I'll get back to you in a couple of weeks. And the book arrived at my house, and it is, I mean, Caleb knows this, it's a heavy tome. I mean, it's dense.
It's actually shorter than Unelected Power, but yeah. Way more. So they've
quite used a bit more
paper. I'm a bit frustrated about that. It's 100 pages shorter than the previous book, but weighs more.
But there's a lot
in it. It is very fine quality paper. I will say that for those that are interested in getting the hard copy, it's a nice feel.
For those who like the high quality printing, for sure. But it's got philosophy. It's got international relations theory. It's dissecting interactions between rival states and states and markets. It's principles for crisis management. You know, you have some agency specific recommendations that I hope we jump into. And then a lot of themes that, as Caleb mentioned, build on Unelected Power regarding independence and legitimacy. So this book arrived at my house, and I emailed Cambridge back and said, 2 weeks isn't going to be enough time. I'm going to need a couple months to digest all of this. But we, you know, there's a great pithy nugget on every page of this book. And so I think I want to start with one. Frankly, we can't start with anything else. There's one quote. If the contemporary hegemon has an unknowing headquarters, it's the Eccles Building in DC. I would love for you to break down that quote for us.
Well, I'm very glad you noticed it to start with. Its origins are that in modern history, by which I mean the last 250, 300 years, each leading state, in terms of military power and security power, has typically also been the issuer of the world's reserve currency. And these things are connected. First of all, there's no doubt that security relationships promotes use of the dollar, just as security relationships promoted use of sterling in the 19th century. But also, the United States' hegemonic role is kind of underpinned by the dollar. In the most obvious way, it makes it cheaper for the government to borrow and dollar-based companies to borrow, and bank American banking has a stronger position throughout the world because of the dollar. But there's also something, I think, more profound, which is illustrated well by what happened in the last crisis. So an incompetently, recklessly run US banking system, inadequately supervised, blows up, smashes the world economy and the world financial system. I mean, the epicenter of it in these United States, what would happen in any other country is the cost of government borrowing would rise. Whereas instead, global funds moved into US Treasury bills and short maturity US Treasury bonds as the safest asset in the world, and the cost of US government borrowing fell. This is the most incredible cushion. It means that even when you're the source of the problem, you have this kind of safety belt that supports you. And the argument that I make in the book, or one of the arguments, is that of course Beijing is going to want its currency to have that kind of advantage. But it also means that if you're the incumbent, which the dollar is, it means that the custodian of that currency, which is the Federal Reserve, is somehow underpinning American power in the world. And the kind of point that I'll make now, since you've provided me with a peg, is that I mean, we're starting to go through the process of the debt ceiling game is being played out in Congress. And quite separately, there's an everlasting debate where lobbyists try to prevent American regulators doing something about the shadow banking system. And they, many of the participants see this as kind of within the beltway activity. And I think that this risks undermining the US position in the world. I think they haven't understood that they're playing with fire. I mean, if ever the debt ceiling thing goes wrong and there's extra volatility in the US Treasury markets, every time that happens, there's somebody in the world that thinks, I think I'll just reduce my holdings of treasuries. I don't think the United States is quite as reliable and its currency quite as reliable as I need to hold so many dollars. And the significance of that is not just for people in finance, it's for people in the Pentagon and people in the State Department and the people that will be in those departments in 5 years' time and 10 years' time. It's no a sterling struggle at the end of particularly the beginning of the 20th century that both accompanied and accelerated the decline of British power. And the Federal Reserve shouldn't make the same mistakes as we did.
Definitely. And there's a great anecdote that you opened the book with, and it's becoming, I think, legend now. The Fed is shopping around swap lines during the global financial crisis, and they don't extend one to India. And you're aghast, not because you think the Fed should be meddling in foreign policy, quite the opposite, but in your view, they aren't cognizant of what's going on above them, so to speak. And you mentioned the partisan infighting around the debt ceiling and other issues that are nominally domestic issues, but have national security consequences, have touch issues in foreign policy. There's kind of a balance here, right? I think you recommend that agencies like the Federal Reserve are narrow in their mandate. But they also need to be aware of the consequences of their policy decisions, right? Help us flesh that out a bit and understand where the line is between understanding the mechanisms going on, the power struggles at play, and then acting on it.
Let me say in advance that I think this is actually quite difficult to reconcile, but it has to be somehow reconciled in practice. The book, the preface of the book, the first sentences in the book are about somebody wandering into my office in the Bank of England some years ago now, and saying the Fed just refused India a swap line. And my response is, don't they realize India is going to be a power? And so the thought behind capital P for power, and the thought behind that is not just China is becoming a power, but that's going to go on a long time, the American Western Chinese contest. And while that's going on, India is going to emerge as a power and be a significant player in this. And actually, we've already seen this. Since that little swap line episode, China went into Indian territory in the north where the borders meet, and that kind of prompted Delhi to go along with the revival of the Quad in the Pacific and Indian Ocean. And so people in the Pentagon and the State Department, they know perfectly well India's going to be a power. And I'm thinking, does the Fed not know? Now, I don't think the Fed should be making decisions on the basis of foreign policy, but I do think that that's a decision, I think, that was above the pay grade of the chairman of the Federal Reserve, or chairwoman, the chairman at the time. I think that was a decision to be taken at a higher level. And even if the Fed had wanted to say no on, if you like, independent central banking grounds, if the US Treasury could have provided a line and the Fed could have funded that. But I think there's a decision there. And I'm not saying what the decision should have been. It's that I want that decision to be, I think it is necessary for our world to survive, frankly, for people who right at the top, who are responsible for taking the longest view and the broadest vision to decide those things, not someone like me, frankly, who just thinks India don't really need it now, and I'm not sure I want to take rupees as collateral against all these dollars. And you think, no, this is bigger than that. So I think they need to be prepared to defer to higher authority, and then if necessary, help the U.S. Treasury do things that they themselves aren't prepared to do directly. I think that's the reconciliation.
Sure. And I think swaps are a good illustration of that, right? I mean, they're an important instrument. And I think the critique is that, swap lines allow the Fed to functionally, pick favored nations to supply dollar liquidity to. And they're important now, and we're talking about the GFC, but you argue in the book that these are going to be increasingly important. And you sketch out a scenario in which the US and China are shopping around their swap lines to the world and basically marketing their currencies. How do you think the Fed should be thinking about its swap line policy going forward? And then more to the point, how should the Fed and other central banks evaluate these rising powers and work with agencies, maybe the treasuries or ministries of finance, to execute strategic financial diplomacy?
Well, I think, first of all, they should think about what it would be rational for Beijing to do and what Beijing is doing. And Beijing has tried to promote the use of the renminbi around the world, including in London, by the way. And as part of those discussions, a swap line is typically offered. And as you know, and many of your listeners, perhaps not all of them, will know, if you go back a generation or more, swap lines were used as part of currency exchange rate management. And Congress became leery about this because they thought providing a swap line reduced the incentives for states to hold dollars in their foreign exchange reserves. I think in a narrow sense, that's true. But that's not a satisfactory equilibrium that we're going to turn down swap lines so as to induce people to hold foreign exchange reserves, dollar foreign exchange reserves. First of all, if they choose not to hold dollar foreign exchange reserves, but they build up lots of short-term dollar liabilities and the music stops, then if the numbers are big enough, the Federal Reserve will end up providing a swap line ex post. That is exactly what happened in 2007, 2008. And secondly, it's not an equilibrium in a deeper sense, because if someone else comes along and says, use my currency, I'll provide you with a swap line, you then think, maybe I need to be slightly more liberal, relaxed in my provision of swap lines so as to underpin the use of my currency. And I can imagine people saying, oh, this is all a bit remote now. The renminbi still isn't as widely used as the dollar or even the euro. And in a sense, that's true. But if anyone takes that position who's in office needs to rethink it every week, because there will be a week, perhaps, where you think, oh my goodness, the renminbi is achieving critical mass, and we've left it too late to keep these people using the dollar. And if you go back to the 1970s, there's a very interesting parallel there. So the United States is in a bit of a muddle in the 1970s. It's not alone in that, but it's very significant. The United States is in a muddle with Watergate and Vietnam costing a lot and social tension and all of that. And then the Bretton Woods regime falls apart, partly because of those domestic tensions. And of course, right at the heart of the Bretton Woods treaty was making the dollar the proximate reserve currency linked to gold. And people in Washington very sensibly recognize that, my goodness, if we don't have a fixed exchange rate regime, will the use of the dollar around the world decline? And there is a mission, there was a mission from Washington to Saudi Arabia. This is an extraordinary moment where security policy and monetary policy come together, where the Saudis are essentially offered a package of, we will continue to support you with arms sales and security, et cetera, et cetera. And in return, please continue to invoice oil in dollars. In academic economics, it's only in the past decade, partly thanks to Geeta Gopinath, that people have realized just how important invoicing is. I think policymakers always understood how important invoicing is. And those people in Washington in the 1970s most certainly did. Sometimes academia opens up new insights, and sometimes they recover the old insights. Keynes is wrong that all practical people are the slaves of defunct philosophers and economists. Sometimes philosophers and economists are kind of catching up with what pragmatic policymakers have known and done for a long time. But that's a key moment. And one of the theses of the book is that very occasionally, the silos that typically exist between different policy fields in, if you like, sustained peacetime, between monetary policy and trade policy, between economic policy as a whole and security policy and lots of other things, that there are moments when those barriers, divisions break down. One of those was in the early to mid 1970s. And we're in another one now. My little dig at the Federal Reserve at the beginning of the book, it isn't so much a kind of personal criticism of the people involved, but saying everybody's been living in silos and getting used to living in silos, but now we're in a bigger game. And, you know, these silos that we've had, these intellectual silos, if you like, are going to be costly for us. And yet somehow we have to reconcile that with the independence of agencies and so on in the kind of ways I've described.
Right. You mentioned trade invoicing, and I want to put a pin in that because that's a pretty compelling use case for central bank digital currencies, which you bring up in the book as one instrument used obviously by Beijing, and there's a lot of pressure on the Fed to consider it. And we'll come back to that in the context of China. But just on you know, considering the Fed's international influence, you know, speaking of India, the former governor of the Reserve Bank of India, Raghuram Rajan, he's mentioned how, you know, he's argued the Fed should consider the spillbacks into the U.S. economy and consider that the reserve currency issuer has an international responsibility to not impose costs on the rest of the world. Recently, Leo Brainard and other Fed officials have begun gesturing toward the international consequences of their monetary policy decisions. And as you mentioned, people get upset. They want some action here. The Fed hikes rates and it exacerbates the problems of indebted countries across the globe. So, I mean, just to drill into this a little bit deeper, how do you think the Fed should be considering the international impacts of domestic monetary policy? I mean, you talk a lot in this book about international organizations, whereas the unelected power was focused on central banks. But when we're considering a central bank like the Fed, the reserve currency issuing institution, when does that cease to become merely a domestic policymaker and become a de facto international organization with a weight of others like Basel and IMF and WTO and what we normally consider an international organization?
You end with a really, really penetrating question. Let's start with Raghuram Rajan. When he was governor of the Reserve Bank of India, he was openly critical of Fed policy, saying that the United States, the Federal Reserve in particular, wasn't taking account of the effects, the spillovers from its policy to the rest of the world. And Raghu, I thought at the time, he was struggling to make this into an economic argument. But it's not really an economic argument at all. It's an argument in international relations and politics. And there's the key sentence from one of his speeches, which I quote in Global Power, which says, actually, the Federal Reserve has a responsibility to do this. Well, responsibility isn't a thing that you'll find in economic models or economic policy. This is, but nevertheless, he made the point. And at the time, the Federal Reserve leadership responded by saying, well, we have to stick to our mandate, which is domestic. And it's another illustration of the point I was making about the swap thing, really. I mean, this is just a myopic response. I mean, it's technically correct, but imagine, I mean, this is not where we're headed, but imagine where the Federal Reserve actually was completely indifferent to the rest of the world and managed to recover stability, having lost control of price stability in the UK, and then US recovered price stability in the US, but utterly screwed up the rest of the world. Do not expect, this is not even 1975, you know, this is not even 1985 with a resurgent Germany and Japan living under the American security umbrella. This is a completely different world where powerful states, newly powerful states, do not rely on the US security umbrella. And so don't expect people to say, well, we're very irritated with the US leadership, but that's how it is, which is, you know, is a caricature of the sometimes European attitude to this would be different from that. I think if one embraces that high level point, it's not easy. If the Federal Reserve signaled, we'll bail you out by providing liquidity assistance to you, however imprudent you are at a national level or in your banking system or in your shadow banking system or whatever, that's a kind of moral hazard problem. I think this should make the Federal Reserve and the US Treasury keen on the IMF sticking to the knitting. One of my themes is everyone should stick to their main job. I don't think either the Federal Reserve or the IMF likes anymore sticking to its main job, but I think it's in the national interest, US national interest, for them to do so. I think Lael Brainard has been gesturing in that direction, and it doesn't surprise me because she's someone whose interests span State Department, Treasury, and Fed, and so she may be somebody that kind of instinctively makes connections. The magnificent question, if I may say so, you went up with is, so if, let me put it in my words, if the Federal Reserve is the real international lender of last resort, not the IMF, and the Fed is closer to being the real international lender of last resort, at least in dollars, isn't it actually like an international organization? And shouldn't it be subject to some of the precepts that I describe? Well, it plainly isn't an international organization in the sense that others are members of it. But I think it does have to have a sense of responsibility, and it does have to be interested in the rest of the world in a kind of really deep sense. I've been lucky enough, of course, to know, I've met all the Fed chairs for a long time. I've known some of them well. And perhaps the one I knew best actually was Paul Volcker, which is kind of slightly odd because he was much older than me. He would be an example of a Fed chair who definitely got it internationally, partly because he was in the US Treasury when the Bretton Woods regime was unraveling in the 70s. And he wrote, when he retired from the Fed, he wrote a book with a colleague from Japan. I have seen other Fed chairs be kind of privately dismissive of Basel, being relieved to escape the Basel process and the international thing. And I just think, I kind of understand the personal feeling, but I think going forward, it's tremendously important that the Federal Reserve chairs and vice chairs see all of that as absolutely central to what they have to do in supporting, you know, our way of life, our constitutional, democratic, liberal way of life. By the way, for American listeners, when I use the word liberal, I'm using it in a European sense. The US lexicon is weird. You say progressive when you mean left wing. You say liberal when you, I don't know what you mean, when you mean kind of mildly left wing. I think the Europeans have got their language of better order on this one. When I say liberal, I mean, and I don't necessarily just mean classical liberal, I mean what is regarded as liberal in Europe, something to do with freedom and the abilities to benefit from the wonders of freedom, which I think everybody on the political spectrum, apart from the bad people, celebrate in the United States.
For sure. And you know, we're speaking, I think, mostly about the monetary side here. And the international monetary system is a big focus of the book. But looking at the fiscal side in the US, just for a moment, I mean, there's a lot going on. So in another context, you had a quote that stuck with me. You said, all policy is security policy. We've mentioned that to some effect, just in our conversation here. And so, you know, we saw the Biden administration, you know, they championed a foreign policy for the middle class. Before then, the Trump administration, or at least the U.S. Trade Representative, was shopping around the phrase "economic security is national security." So we've had this on our mind for a while now in the U.S. But I mean, in your opinion, and we're U.S. centric here at the Reserve, but you've done work on both sides of the Atlantic, and maybe have a fresh perspective to offer. Is the fiscal side capturing all of the nuance of security and economics? And to extend that back to the monetary side too, because we're thinking about how the Fed is operating with Treasury and with state, how should the monetary side incorporate security strategy, if at all?
Well, let me say something first of all about, it's not just fiscal, it's kind of, if you like, the non-monetary part of economic policy. And in particular, I'm thinking of investment controls, inward controls and outward controls motivated by stopping dangerous forms of technology transfer and exports, and in terms of inward investment, stopping kind of cyber interference or other kinds of things with really vital national and international interests. Of course, we've been there before. We were there during the Cold War, and in the early phases of the Cold War, I talk about this, I think, in chapter 3 of the book, the Allies developed machinery, which I think may have been based in Vienna, COCOM, where all the states, all the kind of Western free states, were doing similar things. It was most importantly, the United States was doing them, but the others were doing them as well. But they wanted to avoid, the United States bans something and Britain and Germany and France don't, or the other way around. Britain does and Germany doesn't, and so on. And they had coordinating machinery where they shared information on what they were allowing and weren't allowing, where their concerns were. That machinery then broadened after the end of the Cold War. And I think it may have been reactivated, but I think it probably needs to be reactivated. And this is partly for the reasons I've given, but I think it's also for another reason, to do with the hazard, which is, one starts off, let's say the three of us talking here, and we start off and we really are motivated in banning inward investment or putting constraints, qualifications on outward investment. We really are motivated by what we say is on the tin, if you like, which is national security. And as time passes, actually, it's because of lobbying or because we get carried away or whatever. But it doesn't actually so much matter how it comes around. This kind of slips into a form of protectionism that is not really to do with national security at all, and is kind of welfare depleting in economic terms, and actually isn't adding to national security in any way. And one way of guarding against that is having to go off to an international meeting among friends and allies and say, well, actually, we're going to ban X. I can be Britain. And you two said, what do you mean? X is fine. Why do you want to do that? Why do you really? I mean, actually, we saw something in the paper that you were keen on doing that because of, and then some completely domestic political consideration, nothing to do with security. And I think, you know, there's every kind of state intervention carries a risk of excess, and there's quite a big risk of excess here. And we should remember that in this country on the whole has got a much less unqualified commitment to free trade over its history than my country has since at least the 19th century. And And so national security considerations could easily turn into fortress the United States economy, and that would not be good. And of course, there are some people in this country who have suffered from international trade, but one has to separate that from the unwillingness of Congress and others to do anything about it. This is quite a rich enough country to compensate people and help them adapt to changing technologies and things. That people have suffered from trade doesn't show that trade's bad. It shows that Congress hasn't cared very much about people on the losing side of trade in both parties. Because otherwise something would have happened over the last 25, 30 years. I think for the monetary authority, I don't think they should be seeking to take the lead on any of this, except in one area, which I'll come back to. But they should be sensitive and informed about what's going on. You know, if they're having discussions of a swap line with country X, and meanwhile the security people have concluded that country X is, you know, an imminent and tangible threat to national and international order, you would expect some kind of process there where there was some kind of consultation within Washington and with other allies on what was a prudent thing to do on the swap lines. I think you may want to come back to digital currencies later, but I think it's different when one comes back to digital currencies, because if there's going to be a digital currency here, it's going to be a Federal Reserve digital currency. And yet, because China, it happens to be China at the moment, because China will have a completely different set of aims and constraints on what a decent digital currency looks like, the Federal Reserve, I think, needs to have principles. This is true of Britain and the euro area as well, I think, that have bipartisan support, actually. I could elaborate on that now, or we could come back to it later.
That'd be great to elaborate on it now. And also, I mean, I think just to offer one comment is, you know, when we're talking about CBDCs, we think about how difficult it would be for Western liberal democracies to countenance a lot of the security risks inherent in a CBDC, which, you know, all seem like benefits from China's perspective, monitoring, social control. And one of the core themes of your book is about China and how its party system views its own legitimacy, and it goes beyond just a respect for their party system, but some level of reverence or recognition of China as the Chinese model as a viable alternative to the Western liberal order. So I'm wondering if you can, just touch on some of the security consequences there. You know, how the Fed might view some of that in the context of a CBDC, and touch on China as well there.
I think you've articulated it terribly well. I discussed this at the end of chapter 19, which is the last substantive chapter in the book. And I actually, what I'm going to say, I think Western central bankers have been rather slow to occupy the high ground and a bit too dazzled by the techie stuff, which on the whole is for the kind of middle ranking people. And I was a middle ranking person in a central bank, and I'm very proud and glad that I was. I've got nothing against them whatsoever. But if you think about a digital currency, the really big issue is, does this involve everybody banking in some sense with the central bank? That's the simplest way of putting it. And there are people on the left, in quite left in the United States and in Europe, including Britain, who would like that. And it has three features. It would break with the traditions of banking secrecy that partly developed in my country through the common law during the 19th century. It could be used as a system of social sanctions. And of course, it could be used for credit allocation as well, because if everybody banks with you, then in bad states of the world, for sure, you will end up providing overdraft facilities, in other words, credit. So the central bank morphs from being a narrow central bank of the kind that I like to being a state credit bank. Now, if you're in Beijing, I mean, I don't see why any of that should bother them, given their kind of political economy and deeper beliefs. at the state level, at least. But if you're here, I think you'd want to say, well, we might want a digital central bank currency, but it's going to be constrained by the following things. And I've said on the record before that I think of my old bosses, particularly when Eddie George was governor of the Bank of England between 1993 to 2003. I reckon after this whole business came up about 5 or 6 years ago, I think it would have taken him about 3 or 4 weeks to reach that view. I think he'd have gone off to see the Prime Minister and the Chancellor of Exchequer, the Treasury Secretary, to discuss it, check that they were in line with those things. I think then he would have then made a speech saying so. And the point about that is that the techie people, at that point, kind of me, if you like, at the beginning of his governorship, we then get to work on this idea constrained by those high-level principles, which is actually a damn sight easier if you're a middle-ranking official. You know where the boundaries are. Instead, we had hubs and sandpits and all sorts of things. I mean, I think the whole sandpit language, which the world has wanted to adopt, is the height of irresponsibility. I mean, it's a sandpit mentality that gives you the rubbish of the crypto stuff over the last few weeks. The point about, the broader point about different ways of life is, I think, absolutely profound in that, I'll say two things about it. I mean, because we've lived under an American order and before that, a security order in the world, partly generated by my own country. This is a long time if you put the two together. And one must include France in that as well. It's not surprising that the international regimes and international organizations kind of reflect a certain kind of liberalism. A certain kind of liberalism is absolutely embedded in the GATT and the WTO, and to some extent in other economic regimes and in non-economic regimes. I mean, it's just completely unreasonable cognitively unreasonable to think that Beijing will think that's the best way of organizing the world. You know, in one sense, at the level of kind of positive analysis, why on earth should they, given that their path through history has been different from ours? And I think we should have respect for their own history. I don't think we should be awed by stable Chinese system, civilization, state for 2,000 years. It's had its rough and tumbles, and we should be proud of the Greco-Roman, Judaic, Christian roots of our own ways of life, which go back. I mean, Aristotle and Metius are saying slightly similar things a long time ago. We shouldn't be awed by their history anymore, or if we are, we should be awed by our own history as well. We should be interested in their history, and we should study their history, not all as scholars, but we should know about it. And actually, that's fun, it's really interesting. We should be clear with ourselves about what we must hang on to, what we must hang on to domestically, and what we must hang on to internationally. In particular, we shouldn't casually acquiesce in changes in international organizations or regimes which could jeopardize our way of life at home, by which I mean kind of our political way of life at home. And then a final remark on this is the People's Republic kind of often makes a demand for respect from the rest of the world. And I think it's helpful to think of respect coming in two kinds. Respect as recognition, if you like, as a legal person, which they, I think they largely have. And then respect as esteem. And sometimes they seem to demand esteem, admiration. But that's actually implicitly accepting our point of view. So this is an absolutely fascinating thing. And I think we shouldn't give respect as esteem except where we think it's warranted by our lights. I think we should give respect as recognition in, if you like, the thinnest part of international law, because that's both respectful of their history and it's in our interests, because we need to preserve the peace if we can. That's rather highfalutin and away from the economic stuff, but I want our economic policymakers to kind of have, I mean, Paul Volcker, you know, if you talked about democracy, it was really interesting. And I want our top policymakers to have in their hinterland a broader point of view than you see every day in their speeches.
Yeah.
I don't expect to see it every day in their speeches, but I expect to be able to sense it there. I want to be able to sense it there. And I'll feel more confident of the future if I sense it there.
If you knew that it was something that they were thinking about. To kind of just to wrap it up here on one final question. This past summer, I think we were closer to getting central bank reform here in the United States as we've been since the Dodd-Frank discussions. I think it didn't end up coming to pass, but I had people on the far left and people in the center right reaching out and saying, should I talk to the other person? And so I think that was a sign that we were close. It didn't end up happening. But I wanted to end by just asking, if you were asked advice about preserving long-term central bank credibility and legitimacy. And I know those are distinct topics. But if you had to, if you have advice to give, I just wanted to give you an opportunity to close with that, thinking either to the Fed itself, to Congress, to the White House. How do you think about reforms? I know that's also the final portion of the book.
I think it's really important, both for the Fed itself and for the broader nation, and actually for the world, that the Fed prioritizes price stability, low and stable inflation, and a stable banking system, including a stable shadow banking system, above all else. I think even if, for the broader society, climate change and social justice matter more, I don't think that's where the Fed should spend its time. I think that the Fed has messed up over the past few years and is scrambling to catch up. And if you like, I don't know whether the anchor has slipped, but it's less secure than it was. And that's the Fed's fault. When people criticize the Biden fiscal package, I just don't get that. This is a sequential thing. So Biden's administration, Congress, inject lots of demand into the economy. It's the Federal Reserve's job to kind of ensure that, if necessary, that's offset by tighter monetary policy, which leaves all the distributive and other things intact. And not only did they not do that, they and people around the White House were completely dismissive of the possibility that this could give to inflation. And that was incompetent. I mean, even if it was reasonable, I don't think it was, but even if it was reasonable to have a central view that inflation would remain low or it would only rise temporarily, if one asked the question, were the risks symmetric or were they asymmetric? They were plainly asymmetric. And I don't actually think that any of the individuals involved at policymaking level or staff level are incompetent. It's the outputs that I think were incompetent. And I think this was a reflection of not prioritizing the thing that only they can do. And I think that they would have a much better chance of communicating cleanly to the country and to the world what they're about if they didn't get distracted by other things, however important those other things are. I mean, if any central bank, it's mightily tempting for politicians to think, oh, I can use the central bank to do this and I can do that. In fact, I'd much easier for them to do it than for the Treasury to do it, where I've got to get via all sorts of political procedures. And I think the last crisis had the cost of, it woke people up to just how much central banks could do kind of at the fringes and beyond the fringes of the normal understanding of their mandate. And I think we're paying the price. Well, I think actually the American people and the British people and some of the European people are paying the price for this almost neglect of the core mission. And they just need to get back to it. And when they talk about the anchor, ultimately, they are the anchor. Those men and women are the anchor. and their commitment to price stability and banking stability.
Now, is that so if I'm hearing you correctly, those are more, that sounds like almost a personnel slash a moral conviction of the leadership is required, as opposed to structural reforms. Is that what I'm picking up from you as well? That if Powell had been more committed to the price stability as he is now, and as he preaches that mission now, if he had had that conviction of soul in 2021, that would have been enough. It's not necessary that there needs to be structural reforms. Or
I don't think there's a regime design problem.
Yeah.
I think there's been a regime stewardship problem. Right. I don't think just Jay, some of the presidents, Mary Daly, sounded as though she was championing things that were just completely different. I think that's a perfectly fine thing for somebody to do. I think that some of the other governors were like that. I think it was many of them, actually. I don't think it was just Jay. I think, actually, if there were to be a regime design, it would be this. Of course, some of this happened while some of them were campaigning either to be reappointed or be appointed as Fed chair. I mean, they're only human. I mean, I don't criticize them for that at all. I think it would be better if there was one term of 8 years or one term of, we moved to this in the UK. There used to be 5 years and then possibility of a second 5 year term. And the renewal thing, the government would kind of pretend that they weren't going to reappoint. And the incumbent would pretend that they weren't really interested in being reappointed. And this happened in 1993, 2003. And then, it's all the years in between, actually. Then we paid some costs to that. So I think moving to an 8 year term would be an improvement.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, these are a few food for thought, listeners. I'm going to include also not only in the show notes links to both of Paul's books, because they are best read together, if by chance you haven't already read Unelected Power, but also a list of a few upcoming events where Paul will be speaking. So, Paul, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks very much to both of you. It's been really good to talk to you both. Thank you.
Yeah, Carrie, thanks for joining me, and we'll do it again soon.
It'd be great. Thanks so much, Paul.